Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Getting my dad to say I love you.
To say what?
Say he loves it.
Outrageous.
Bloody nonsense.
Dads, this week we've got Sarah Kendall on the podcast. Are you excited?
Yeah, that sounds good.
So loud. You're way louder than you were when we tested the mics there. You were so excited, you nearly broke the sound barrier with that. You're that excited. What do you know about Sarah Kendall, Dad?
Not very much, I'm afraid, but I should have done a bit more work, really. But
Did you read the Wikipedia page, at least?
Yes, I did, yes.
Well, what do you know about her?
Well, she's a comedian.
Yeah.
And she's... does comedian stuff.
Poor research right now, Dad. It's poor research. What? This is poor research.
Hang on, I can do it fairly quickly now.
Well, no, it's too late. You had
I did have a look, but I just got waylaid.
You had a look and you stopped at Sarah Kendall and the word comedian. She's a great comedian. She's a great writer. She's been nominated for the Edinburgh Award.
She was nominated for various things. That's right. I noticed that.
Yeah, okay. An awesome person. She's got a great TV show out on HBO and in Australia, and I think it's in the UK, called Frayed. She's great. She also was at the airport the day after I got engaged when I was with my now wife, and was very happy for me, which is nice.
I didn't know that. That wasn't in Wikipedia.
Wasn't in Wikipedia. Weirdly, that didn't make the cut on her own Wikipedia page, but as much as she would love to.
All right.
Well, I'm going to go chat to Sarah. I'm going to find out more than you did that she's a comedian, and I'll speak to her and I'll get back to you afterwards and I'll ask her a question on your behalf. Welcome my guest for this episode, the fantastic and awesome and lovely Sarah Kendall. How are you, Sarah?
I'm well, Chris Martin. I always enjoy saying the full version.
Name. Yeah, because of the Coldplay guy?
Never wears thin for me. It literally never wears thin. I had this thing when I was writing a script ages ago that it's always funny when a character has a famous person's name and it isn't. And one of my characters was called Diana Ross. And I get like a sort of a 30% thrill of if I had met someone who was like a librarian called Diana Ross.
I'm like the nicotine patch of famous names.
Yeah.
Well, Sarah, what I like to do, as much as I'd love to talk about myself on this podcast, as a narcissist, I always love to ask guests straight out of the gate, have both your parents said the full phrase, I love you, to you before in your life?
Yes, and frequently. And I've also noticed that everyone in my family, like with my brother, my mum and my dad, we sign off on conversations with I love you. Like that's really normal.
That's been inbuilt from from a youth. That's so nice.
Yeah. I think I say I love you quite readily in relationships.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
You mean as in someone you're dating or just like any friendship or anything?
Oh, anyone I love. I'm very comfortable. And friendships as well.
Oh, nice.
Like, I don't have to get hammered to tell people I love them. I'm pretty, I will, like, just freely tell friends and lovers I love you. Like, I'm not cagey about it.
This is way too functional for this pod. I mean, like, I don't know how we fill an hour now with that information, but that's nice, though. That is nice.
Yeah, but when it doesn't come back to you instantly, you know, there is a... There is, if you don't get the, you know, and you, like, it's it can sting a little. I mean,
I was going to say, how quickly did you say it to you're married, right? It's your husband.
Well, look, we're going to have to edit this bit out, but I'm divorced now. I mean, that's how much time has passed.
Oh,
yeah, yeah,
God.
Yeah. I mean, maybe we don't have to edit it out.
Well, I
mean,
it's not a secret. I'm with you. Okay. Well, we can, yeah, but that is awkward. I did message you saying the last time you saw me was when I just got engaged, and that was with you were with husband and children then.
And I didn't want to shit on your picnic because that was such a lovely way for you to reach out and for me to go, well, guess what? You know, like I didn't want to be that person.
Screw you guys. All right. But you say, okay, well, but you say it in general.
You could put this in the podcast.
If you want to put it in there, it's good. It was going too well. You were saying everything was so nice and positive. It's good.
And look where it's landed me. Look where it's fucking landed me. Oh, keep it all in, Chris. Keep it all in.
Do you know what, though? In the positive glass half full way, I'm sure it has all happened and it is better and for a reason, etc.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to go to Leonard Cohen because I can't bear him, but, you know, like, the cracks are where the light shines in, I think is the paraphrasing of that. But I have always kind of had a weird, I'm not sure if I believe myself. I think maybe I'm trying too hard to present a certain way, even as I say it out loud. I've never sort of felt cagey about being in, certainly when I was younger and I misfired a lot. I mean, as you meant to misfire a lot with relationships and, you know, blurt out I love you just before you throw up from all the tequila. Like, I've done that. I've done all that. But now in middle age, I'm quite confident that my love is, this sounds so eggy. It's a good thing and it's a nice thing to bestow upon a person.
That's good.
I always think I'd rather err on the side of my kids feeling too loved and there being too much demonstrations of that than the other end of the spectrum. You can't get it right. You're either going to aggravate them or neglect them. So to try to fall somewhere in a comfortable middle point of those two things is my aim.
I think that's very healthy, to be honest. Just bestow that love and then they won't pursue this. I mean, the thing is, most people haven't said it, had it said enough. That's why they end up being performers and stuff. But you had it said all the time and you went into performance.
Do you think that's your Britishness? Is that
maybe
is
it's
that
a British? That's a good point because it's very much a. I remember I said I love you to my mum once when I was in. Actually, I was in Vegas with some friends for Christmas like a few years ago. I just didn't go home for Christmas. I don't know if she was pissed off about that, but I said, "Oh, Mum, I love you," and she went, "Oh, thanks." And then I was like. But like she does, obviously, but she just doesn't. And then my dad, the whole thing is in this, he was brought up to not say it. You don't say it. You can feel it and display it, but just saying it's like a sign of weakness. So that might be
a sign of weakness.
I feel not necessarily like he was given shit for it, but I think it's just, I feel like that's, I think that might be a British thing.
I really think it is.
Vulnerable, isn't it? Yeah.
I think there is a certain Britishness. I certainly noticed with my ex-husband. It really moved me when he would say I love you to his mom, and she would sort of go yes. Like, it was like and it was an acknowledgement, and in its own coded way, it was, you must know I love you as well because I'm your mother. But it was never said. It just, and seeing him make that overture to her and for it to sort of come back as a sort of awkward acknowledgement it was heartbreaking. And he's really so open and loving with our kids, I think. I think that has sort of the fire that he's been forged in is to not do that to his own children.
Yeah, when we have kids, I know I'll be just very effusive with the loveys, because you just got to just chuck it in there. Get it done early. Get it out of the way early. Get it, make it a habit, and then it's going to be nice. But so your parents then, they bestowed, well, they said I love you a lot, and is quite a loving family. So when it came to the common theme is everyone I think who does this type of career to some degree has to have an insane work ethic. As much as people think comics, etc., are lazy, I don't actually agree.
No, I disagree too.
They just think, also just like, you know, we just like a lie-in, but we can still work for just later on into the day. And fearlessness. So I'm curious, when you were younger, did you, yeah, were your parents strict on you? Did they want you to get into this field? Was it, were they just go and do whatever you want?
They were quite disappointed because it just...
you said that. So, the way you said that, but you could say they were quite supportive, but you just dropped in disappointment.
No. There was, I mean, all the things that you would fear and dread about a relatively intelligent, capable university student dropping out to pursue stand-up. I mean, it does have all the warning signs written all over it as a terrible idea. So they were concerned. They were very concerned. I think the thing that my mum, not so much my dad, because my dad couldn't get his head around, he barely even knew what stand-up was.
Of course, yeah.
So for me to drop out to pursue stand-up was incredibly disappointing, I think, for him. But I think my mum had a bit more confidence in me because that thing that you mentioned about the work ethic, I've always had a really good work ethic, and she had a certain confidence that that work ethic would stand me in good stead, which I think was incredibly wise of her because in terms of raising my own kids, I keep on saying to my daughter, it doesn't matter how capable any of you or your contemporaries are, the people with the work ethic are going to be the ones who make it, because a natural ability will only get you so far.
Correct.
And all the people who I really respect and admire have, on top of being capable and talented, have worked their fucking guts out. Like, that's the connective tissue between them all.
Yeah.
You know, and I also think that 90% of that work ethic is showing up on time and having done your homework.
I know.
Like, if you the amount of times that you are so much further ahead of the pack for showing up on time and having done your homework. Like, it's really basic kind of stuff.
I know. But
yeah, I love it. I love it. I love the person who is punctual and prepared.
I know. I always like joke about this, like, with hand, like some people, you know, we write together and we do, you know, this and do stand. I said to some like person, I was at some like comedian's drinks thing after something, and I said, oh, I've got to go back because I've got to get up tomorrow, like, in the morning and write. And she was like, what? Yeah. It's like, what else am I going to do in my day? And then you just realize, like you said, 90% of people don't, or when it comes to even, I think this applies to all fields of work. Mm. I don't have an office job, and I'm thankful that I don't have like a proper office job, even though if you want to do that, that's fine. I reckon people maybe do 4 hours of work in an 8 hour day maximum, really. But like the amount of just doing the bare minimum that blows people's minds is just, it's just so, how many people are fucking up and not doing work makes you just, you're right. Just
but even more so, I think even more so in show business.
Yeah.
If you turn up ahead of time and you've learned all your lines, people lose their shit. They're like, wow, you were early and you knew 3 pages of script. Like, I do think the bar has been set phenomenally low in terms of behavior. I think my mum was the only thing that she had confidence in was that I had worked really hard in high school, not so much in uni. I lost my way in uni because I had worked so hard at school and then got to uni and just found it to not be in any way inspiring. I sort of, my course was wasn't really getting much out of it, and I didn't know where it was going. And then I found this really odd outlet of stand-up, and it gave me direction. It gave me direction in a way that my uni course really didn't. And I think I had a sort of recklessness that I was young enough to go, well, if it doesn't work out, I'll just go back to uni. Like, let's give it a couple of years and see what happens.
What did they do when you were younger for jobs?
Oh, well, dad, a dentist, and my mum, a housewife. She's a, you know, full-time mum.
Right.
So really, really traditional, like
yes,
a very traditional and a very safe setup. And My mum was also very adamant that I get a career, because that was the thing that she didn't do that she really regretted.
Yeah, that makes sense. So
then it was her night of a thousand nightmares when I came back and went, I'm dropping out of uni. And she was like, well, I wanted you to get your education. But what I found really sort of interesting about the path of doing stand-up and going from stand-up to, you know, television work, I had a really interesting conversation with Rich Hall, and it must have been like 15 years ago. And he said to me, don't ever let your stand-up slip, because that's your trade. TV shows are going to come and go. You might go 3 seasons, 4 seasons, you might go 1 season, but it'll end. And you are going to have to go back to your trade, and you can always fall back on it. So in a way, I feel like my stand-up is, if I needed to tomorrow, I could go out and earn from doing stand-up and I could get back on the circuit. Like, that for me is the thing. I'm always waiting for the TV gig to end.
Yeah.
And then I will go back to stand-up, which is how I, you know, that's sort of my... That's the thing that I didn't do by getting a university degree, but I got it through doing stand-up, my security.
I think that's actually a very good way of looking at it. You can, no one can really stop you or end you doing stand-up apart from yourself, right? But the other things, that's out of your control a lot of the time.
Dare I say his name, Louis C.K. There was a fantastic episode of Louis where he meets Joan Rivers. Mm-hmm. And it was just this episode that really... it really affected me, because it's just a brilliant. It was a brilliant episode. I know he is an incredibly problematic character in comedy, so it really galls me to say that I adored this episode. But it was fantastic, and it was basically Joan Rivers playing the main room, and Louis C.K. is playing the shittiest smaller room, and he doesn't like the conditions. People are getting up and getting drinks, and you know, he wants to discontinue his run. He's at Vegas for a week and he's in this shit cabaret bar, and he goes to see Joan Rivers in the main room. Mm-hmm. And he's like, he gets to hang out with her afterwards, and he's already told his agent that he wants to discontinue his run at Vegas because of how disrespectful the crowd is in the cabaret bar. And he has this amazing conversation with Joan Rivers, and she says to him something along the lines of, you fucking call your agent and tell your agent you're going to finish your run. I have been in the main room and the cabaret bar, back to the main room, back to the cabaret bar all through my career. And I'm in the main room now, and I'll be back to the cabaret bar next year. Like, it's a fight and a struggle, and you have to go out and keep earning. And when I'm not famous, I'm back in the cabaret bar, and sometimes I get the wind in my sails and I'm back in the main room. But you have to finish your run, because it's a contract and that's what you do as a work ethic. It's just a really... I feel like it's the sort of thing that all performers, that's the thing you get your head around. It's a long career path, mm-hmm. and it's not all, you're not always in production. You're not always getting scripts off the ground. It's a fucking slog at times.
Yeah, and then to enjoy the fact that the slog that we have is more fun than 90% of other versions of a slog, I would say.
Do you ever worry about your ideas? I've been really worried about...
Oh, mate, all the time. I'm like, I've got nothing. I've like, especially because I'm pretty happy. I'm happy and...
Oh, no. What are you doing?
I know. But also there's unhappy stuff happens. It's like actually, it's like I'm doing therapy at the moment, which is like, just like being positive. It's actually been really helpful. But your brain does... It's great though. It's really good. Yeah. You started paying a bit more attention to stuff that you hadn't really paid attention to, which I think is actually quite handy.
Yes.
But I do think that, and then I realize kind of no, because I go, sometimes some stuff will fall away. Like we were trying to come up with a new idea the other day. I was like, we've got no good new ideas for none. And then just by talking and living, a couple of weeks later, good ideas happen. Or stand up, I'll have like no fucking ideas for ages. And then I just need like a bit of time and gigs in the diary, and then I'm like, oh yeah, immediately it starts. I kind of realize, like, what am I don't want to be retired. The idea of just doing nothing is so boring to me, and like I don't want to just lie on an island or whatever. So I'm like, well, I'm just gonna keep it's just, what else are you gonna do? Gonna keep happening. But yeah, obviously the fear is like, I've got nothing, in especially when you see some people who like they get super successful, and you think your life is so, you could tell their stuff is like really patched together. You know what I mean? I'm not going to name any names, but their stand up, you're like, oh, you've got nothing of particular interest to talk about, but you have to do an hour to, because you've got to make your money.
Yeah. It's, I had a writer's meeting with someone who I've, from stand up, who I've just known for years, and we're like, we should work on something together. And, I love how in writer's room, and I've script edited for her show. Like she wrote and directed a show that I script edited on. So we've worked together a lot. And I love that all of our writer's meetings end up with sort of one of us lying on the ground talking about a thing that happened 25 years ago. And I'm like, those are the writer's meetings that I live for, you know, like.
Yeah.
One of you's under a coffee table with a pillow over your head going, there was this guy at my school, and you sort of, I feel like you're sort of unpacking stuff because you're trying to, it's like picking up a bunch of rocks and looking underneath them going, is there anything in that? Is there something there?
And yeah.
I've had some of my most powerful revelations in having like writers' meetings with her, because we're always trying to find those kernels of truth that you go, this is something I give a shit about, and this is something I want to write about. Like, if I can take that experience and dramatize it, or, you know, when you're stuck in a script and you're going, what would this person do? And you're like, well, actually, there's this one time when I was at band camp. You do have these sort of, when you're trying to figure out what your character would do, often you look into your own life and go, what's got the ring of truth? Well, what did I do when I was, you know, in a similar mess? So there's something about script writing that I find very therapeutic, because you're sort of looking for behavioral truths, which you can only get by analyzing your own life.
Yeah. I you said something that was very interesting there. You said about stuff you give a shit about. And actually, sometimes I find with, I don't know if this resonates with what I love about a script versus stand-up, as much as I love stand-up. Sometimes in stand-up, I feel like you're hemmed in by your sort of persona on stage and what you, I mean, you can talk about whatever you want, people say, but ultimately I still think like who you are will inform what an audience will want to hear from you to a degree. Do you know what I mean? Like, for example, I guess I could, maybe I can now. I don't know. But I've always thought I wouldn't want to hear me talk about like going down on someone like that. Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean.
But I feel like if you write a script, you have characters and you can have one who's into talking about that. And so you can, but not to say I wouldn't want to talk about it, but it's just great. You have the freedom to kind of go into different truths from your life and experiences, and you can kind of express them in so many different ways. So I find that quite freeing. Yeah. As much as people think scripts is like, oh, you can't be free. I'm like, actually, I find that quite freeing.
That's so true. And also I find it really terrible when there's someone I like and then, you know, during their set, they do say something really grubby about sex. I'm like, oh.
Oh, fuck. I've had a green tea with you. That's weird.
Yeah, we're going out for noodles after this. You fuck. Oh, fucking hell. Yeah, I know. It's tricky, isn't it?
Just to circle back a little bit then. So your dad being a dentist, right? That's a traditional job.
There.
And your mum is she arrived with them, got like a create, like your mum hobbies and stuff. Is there some sort of creativity that's been sort of knocked around? Or is that completely self-created by you?
Grandparents
or anything? No.
Yeah. It's hard for me to know. I mean, both of my parents were sort of, children of military folk.
Oh, right.
So my mum was a RAF brat. So she grew up on RAF bases in the 50s and 60s, which, as you can imagine, you know, it was a really, because my grandfather was a fighter pilot, you know, and he wasn't a particularly pleasant guy. Like, there was no kind of sort of Jack Kerouac phase of her life where she just feed it all out on the road. You know, like
she missed that bit.
Not that I have either, but, you know, she, you know, there was that sort of very military kind of upbringing, which is not, doesn't sit very comfortably with the arts. And then my dad was sort of a, you know, that again, his father was, had fought in World War II, and my dad had a really paramilitary upbringing because the expectation was that he would have a war, you know, that his grandfather had had World War I, his dad had had World War II. So these kids were brought up for the next war, whatever that was going to be. And Vietnam came along a little bit too late for my dad. He was too old. And he told me at the time he was absolutely fucking devastated. He was desperate to go to Vietnam.
Wow.
Because he thought that was his generation's calling. So he had been brought up on rifle ranges, and all these boys in the 50s, their fathers were raising them with the expectation of, well, you'll be the next generation of men in our family to go off to some war. So there was a very conservative. It was a very
were they strict? Were they strict?
Yeah, very.
Yeah, I was going to say, it feels like it'd be odd if they were kind of like, so that's, so I bet that's, they were like, you have to do your, like, are they like, on your homework, don't fuck about school. That's interesting.
Yeah. And as much as I sort of reacted against it when I went to uni, and I still kind of respect that they drilled that discipline into me. Mm. Like, there's a lot of things that I can criticize about those sort of conservative military upbringings, but it does instill a work ethic in you. Like, and I know there are other ways to get results out of people. You don't have to bash everybody with a big stick to get results.
Yeah.
I know that there is a sort of velvet gloved approach that is equally productive, but it's kind of weird. Like, something that I've sort of noticed in therapy is just how much that sort of work ethic and that kind of military, it's been a benefit to me, but it's also made me very tough on myself, and not giving myself enough of the nice things. You know, like, there is that sort of I suppose there's virtue in being very disciplined and not having too much fun, and don't let go too much.
I was going to say, when you, does this resonate? Even I didn't have the same background. I didn't have such a strict background, but I have this kind of same sort of thing of needing to just like work and like be unhappy if I'm not kind of always doing stuff. Do you, when you know, you've got a TV series on that's people love and is well reviewed. Do you ever enjoy it? Do you ever enjoy the thing?
I enjoy nothing. I mean, that's kind of like,
is that what the therapy is to help with that, right? You need to get to okay, good. Okay.
Yeah. And I'm getting better at going, for God's sake, you will be dead sooner than you know. So try to enjoy something. So even, like, I used to have this thing that even when I was on holidays, the guilt that I would feel for being on holidays, I would be thinking, I should be working, I should be writing. I would ruin my holidays by working on the holiday. So I'd book a holiday and then bring my laptop and go, the only way I can holiday legitimately is if I get up early and get my writing done before the day starts, and then I can go and, you know,
I know that.
You know, have my day. So I... a lot of it has sort of been easing off a little bit on that, and being a bit more forgiving of myself.
That's good.
But, yeah. And also, you know, something that I find really curious is just how much I imitate my dad. You know, and he is really disciplined, and that, and I kind of get that that's been a big key to him having a good life. You know, like, the biggest thing, the headline note I would say there is his discipline.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, sometimes you're like, yeah, I mean, also it doesn't hurt to take your foot off the gas a little bit. And I think that that's something that I've arrived at in middle age, but also raising my daughter to not be too hard on her and to let her know that, you know, your failures are important. And I don't know. Just taking it a bit easier. I think
that's very, it takes a long time for, it's taken me a long time to kind of get to that point. It's like, what are we doing all this for if we're not going to try and find the happiness world? Because you know, I remember I've had stuff in my career of, I've got that thing. As soon as I got it, I'm already thinking about the next. I don't enjoy that thing, but because I think you think, if I enjoy it, then I'll just become complacent. But ultimately, that's kind of ridiculous, because this is not going to happen, is it? You're not going to randomly just change a full habit of a lifetime and just stop working and get hammered on an island for a year, as much as that sounds fun for about 10 minutes.
No, I think also that something that I've sort of realized with a bit of age and time is that nothing lasts forever. So just say I did absolutely crucify myself and write my masterpiece, it will also get swallowed up by time and people will forget about it and I'm going to die. Like, mm-hmm. it's when I think about the people who, and this is not like in a sort of schadenfreude way. It's going to sound really mean, but hear me out. Like, there are people who I knew 20 years ago who had stratospheric success.
Yeah.
You know, they just frog leaped over everyone mm-hmm. and got to the top in a nanosecond whilst the rest of us were sort of still mucking around in the fucking trenches. Yeah. And my daughter has no idea who these people are. She's never heard of them. And there's something about that time lapse where you kind of it's sort of easing into your mortality a bit and going, even if you do make Apocalypse Now, like, it's just another movie. It's just another script, and it's another TV show that will be swallowed up by time. My daughter's never heard of most of the icons of my youth. When I mention them, you sort of go, well, you're not going to be achieving some sort of immortality by this. Mm-hmm. It's all going to be forgotten. So just fucking lighten up a little bit.
I agree. This sounds also morbid. A couple of, like, people, as you get older, like, people you know, like, either worked with or people die. Mm-hmm. And then it just, like, you know, you see on Twitter, everyone's like, oh my God, this is awful. This person's died. And then a week later, I mean, obviously different people, but you go, yeah, like, I've always been a bit scared of that. I was like, when I die, you think, oh, who gives a fuck? No one will give a fuck. It's like, I live in another, no one gives a shit. If you go to another country for a year and you go, oh my God, people are like, oh, were you away? I didn't even know. Like,
God.
No one cares. Yeah. No one cares about us. That's what's kind of freeing in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I had people sort of say to me, are you gigging at the moment? I'm like, I haven't gigged in 3 years. Like, no one's noticed. It's not like the laughter has stopped.
Yeah.
And I think that the only thing that I get, and this is the sort of, you know, the sort of the balance to this, is that when I see something genuinely brilliant, I love it so much, and it also pains me a little bit because I'm like, I want to do that one thing in my life where I go and I just get it right. Mm. Just, you know, when you see something that
makes you have all the feelings and the light, just has every 100%. Yeah.
It's like eating a 12 course meal where every plate is more delicious than the last. And, you know, you see that work of art and you're like, and this is also part of the I am going to be dead one day. I want to create something in my body of work where you mm-hmm. go, well, that's your godfather. That's your, Francis Ford Coppola seems to be quite prominent in my thoughts today. Because it is so, when it is right and when it's done so well, it just kind of feels like the pinnacle of human existence. Like, you realize that's why people go mad trying to come up with great scripts. And because when it's all just done so beautifully and how rewarding that feels, that does, even though I am quite glib about, well, we're all going to be dead one day, I do find that perfection. Like, I can still watch The Apartment and go, that's a perfect movie. There is not an ounce of fat on that script.
Yeah.
And there is something about watching people who have all been dead for quite some time and to put that movie on and go, yeah, it's still the tensile strength of its perfection has not been eroded by time.
That I can, there's something, how you frame that is also interesting, because you could frame that as like this weight of I need to do it, but actually the sort of message behind it is you, when you watch something great, it makes you feel amazing and you just want to make other people feel that way, right? Which is kind of a nice thing, but yeah, it's hard to do that with the balance of like, don't put this crazy expectation on yourself, whereas actually just trying to make something that brings joy and makes people have different thoughts and feelings is a good gift to try and aim to do, but don't be so hard on yourself.
Come here, son.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Do you ever read anything that's about stoicism? I'm just curious, because you're talking about we're going to die soon. It's like, actually, I've been reading some stuff on stoicism at the moment. It's actually quite interesting for just sort of...
Go on.
Learning to be... Well, it's kind of basic. It's just like, don't let external factors affect your happiness. And it's just really about how you can control how you feel. And that's all you can do, which is kind of a basic message. But it's sort of... There's this book I've been reading, which is Forged Over Lord... you know, it kind of came from Marcus Aurelius, was the kind of the godfather of it. And it's got some, what was this, a really fun phrase in it, a good quote from Marcus Aurelius. Humans, it's amazing how humans only really care about ourselves, yet we still put so much weight on what other people think about us. I was like,
that's so true. That's so fun. True. Yeah. I haven't. I keep on, because all the things that I try to do for mindfulness, and I'm not saying like I'm, you know, some special unicorn, but they frequently don't work. Like I've often used like Headspace, and I've tried, you know, meditation and all these other things, and I haven't gone wild for it. And I took up karate a couple of years ago, and that's sort of got really, that's sort of like my sweet spot in terms of meditation, because... I mean, I don't know how mindfulness is defined, but for me, it's just, you know, being completely and utterly in the moment when nothing else exists outside of that moment. And I have found that karate training and it's fulfilled something in me that has allowed me to be incredibly present. And I enjoy it. I enjoy it immensely.
That's good, mate. What belt are you? I've always wanted to be good at a martial art, but I've never actually pursued it.
Oh, really? I mean, do you know, it's made me a lot more serious about my fitness. Like, I've got a grading coming up. I'm a red belt now going for my blue belt. So it's pretty low. Well. But, I mean, I'm like one of the oldest fucking people dojo.
I just loved that. That was such a hard on yourself, comedians. I'm going for my blue. It's pretty low. You had to shit on yourself there, right? You couldn't just be happy for yourself. You've taken up a thing that's made you feel better and you're doing well and you're like...
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I shat on my own picnic. You're quite right.
You did.
But... I mean, I also have the pride thing of knowing that I'm one of the oldest people in the dojo. So I just out of self-respect, I'm sort of secretly training a bit more because I don't want to be looked down on. But I really enjoy it. And there's something about it's drained a lot of the anger out of me. Like I was really prone to road ragey incidents and shit that probably was putting myself in danger in terms of like, if I got, you know, if someone dipped in front of me into my 2 second gap, you know, fucking hold down the horn and you know, like the fuck, you fucking idiot. Like there was so much anger. Like, I've just sort of, I don't know, there's something about going into a dojo 2 to 3 times a week and hitting people and getting hit. Like, you do get hit and you bruise and you have injuries. And it's just made me a lot more, I take violence a bit more seriously now. Okay. I think
So that military background, mate, is coming out.
Yeah, hauling down your horn and calling someone a cunt. Like, if they do choose to get out of their car you've escalated it. You have escalated it.
You've escalated that.
Can't your ego tolerate someone?
I know.
Closing in on your 2 second.
I let anyone cut in on me because everyone has. Because of guns and stuff here. Hannah has on more than one occasion when I've been driving honked the horn and I'm like, what are you doing?
What are we doing?
Don't get me killed. I was fine. I was fine with that person taking the tech car again. I don't want to die. I love this pod because I'm having a lovely chat about all sorts, but people can listen to what bits they. No one's going to be on here going, where's the solid parent chat? That's not what's going to happen because I think it's interesting. Whichever avenue we get taken into, I love it. But I was going to say that the thing that I was thinking when you were talking about your dad and like the kind of discipline stuff, does he have any... My dad has, and this has come up a few times, has phrases that I just have in my head, like, got to keep the show on the road. Just got to keep the show on the road. What's happening? Always says, what's happening? So again, like probably I've always got to be... What if I've got anything to talk to him about? I mean, quite comically the other day... I rung them up. My parents hadn't spoken to him for like a week. Me and Hans, I think we'd just been writing. I hadn't done any gigs or something. I don't know. I just rung him up for a catch up and I realized I had so little, nothing had been happening. They had been a bit unwell. So I hadn't done it. And I was just like, this is a 4 minute conversation. No one's got anything to report back. So, but yeah, him going, what's happening? And got to keep the show on the road have always been in my head. So I'm just curious, did you, any little kind of parental like phrases that have been drilled? The other one was never be a lawyer. That was the other one. Those are the three.
Wow. Yeah, fair enough.
So I did that. I achieved that goal.
Yeah, well done. God, what are his recurring... show me the sign that says life's fair. That's great.
There you go. I love that. That's a good solid. Don't complain. Yeah. Get on with it. Yeah. Work your
And ass. Also, what right do you think you had? It's really funny. There was a Twitter meltdown that somebody sent me. I have to be quite careful with how I phrase this. I'm a real fan of the Twitter meltdown.
Who isn't?
It's one of my favorites. It's the whole reason I'm on that bin fire of a sudden. Anyway, so there was this Twitter meltdown, and you sort of realize that it's just a really good mantra. Anytime you're like, but that's unfair. Like, what do you think this – what, do you think God's watching?
I know.
Do you think God's looking after you? Like, it's a – pale blue dot, mate. You know, like there is no logic or rhyme or reason to any of this, and you'll send yourself mad if you think there is.
Sorry, I just cut you off. You're going to say that? Were you going to go into the meltdown?
No, I better not.
I mean, can you go into it after when we stop recording? Can you tell me?
Oh, I'll send it. Oh, I will send it to you on Twitter.
It to me,
you
please.
Are just 30, okay. Yeah, it's choice grade. It's good stuff.
But I agree though with your dad's sentiment there, which is like I always think the universe doesn't give a shit about you. Is actually it's the same as you're going to die, so just have fun. The universe doesn't give a shit about you. Sounds negative, but actually, just like just
it's quite nice.
It's good. Just get on.
But it's also his other refrain is from a book that he gave me that sort of really affected me, Slaughterhouse 5. Like I went through my obligatory Kurt Vonnegut phase in my 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And there was just the refrain of the main character. He just constantly says, and so it goes. Like that's this character has all these things happen to him and he always says, and so it goes. I think that's what he says. No, I've said it out loud. I'm not confident. And so
I'm not, I don't know, and I'm not going to look it up. So let's say that's what it is. We don't need to, we're not going to, I'm sure someone will correct you in the comments as people like to do if it's an issue.
I'm pretty sure that's a quote, but suddenly as I said it, I thought, is that the quote?
So it goes. Sounds like a quote. It sounds like a real thing someone would say.
Yeah. What else does he say? He's got a lot of, and this is in terms of his discipline. So he's 1944 birth, so 76 this year. And he puts on his trainers and goes for his walk every morning and he swims most of the year round, like he does his 800 meter swim in the mornings. And, you know, he sort of says the amount of times I get up and I can find 1,000 reasons to not put on my trainers or not go for my swim. Like every morning I can find a reason to not go. And the discipline is you put your trainers on, and you, as soon as you got your trainers on, you're halfway there, mate. Like,
that's true.
And that's exactly what discipline is I can find 1,000 reasons to not go to karate. I can, there's always going to be a reason to not do the thing, but discipline is where you go, I'm doing it because it's not a discussion. I'm doing it because it's the first thing in the morning and I'm going to go and swim 800 meters. Like, and I think there's something about that behavioral trait that I've definitely mimicked in my own life.
But like, that's good. That's what you need. You need that with, like you said, you're doing the script, stand up, everything. You need to, I mean, there's the odd, like, you know, crazy lunatic, like prodigy who can just fucking making it up. But I mean, I don't even, I think that's always exaggerated a bit. I think that's exaggerated a bit when someone goes, I just wrote it all on stage. I'm like, no, you've been thinking about that for probably every minute of the day for the last 2 weeks or whatever it is.
There's also, I think, what's interesting about just in karate is I'm always fascinated. Like, did you see The Last Dance? The basketball.
Yes, that was amazing. Yeah, of course.
Yes. Incredible. So I'm really interested in champions. You know, like those top 0.0001% of champions. And there's a couple of champions in the dojo, and they're just wired a bit differently. You know, like there's the thing in The Last Dance when Michael Jordan, he'd gone to the finals. What do they call it? The finals? I don't know if that's even what the word is.
Yeah, it's the finals.
The finals. And he had gastric bug and he was just basically exploding from both ends. And then he went out and played the greatest game of his life. Mm-hmm. And in those conditions, most people would be laid up in a hospital on a drip. And I am not a champion, but I'm fascinated by the champions in the dojo because if the sensei says halfway through sparring, now drop and do 30 burpees, these fuckers will get to 30 and then they'll do another five. They have this, and part of it is, I think, a tolerance to pain. I think that there is like a certain amount of it where they just can kind of, but there's also a desire there that is, like I get to the 30th burpee and I go, I can't do another one. I just can't do another one. And I'm not going to do another one because you said 30. And if you say, give me five more, I'll say no, because you said 30. Whereas the champions are naturally driven to try to squeeze in five more because this is their opportunity to get better.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not built like that. I mean, I have
a runner up.
Yeah, I'm a silver medalist.
Yeah, that's still pretty good. It's not bad.
But I'm so impressed by it. I'm impressed at how when my body's conking out, it's not negotiable. Like, you know, like if I can't do any more, I will say to my sensei, I'm sorry, but I can't do any more. I've got nothing left. I'd have to be heaving to say that, but I'd say it. Mm-hmm. Whereas that's just not an option for a champion. They just find it somewhere.
But do you not think that's also partly because that's not the field that you're not a professional karate. You're not like, so like in terms of if they were watching you do stand up and like you did a show and someone went, that's pretty good. You went, it wasn't good enough. And then you go back and listen and you make notes and you try and improve and make it better.
Yes, I suppose.
Champion meds. But I agree. That's a physical sporting champion. I mean, I used to play like rugby at quite a high level and football. But I was like, oh, just the level of, like, I didn't want to do that enough to just, I want to fucking destroy my body to get into.
Yeah.
Someone told me there was a guy like my height who's then playing for England. He like would just be in the gym like 3 hours. And I was like, I don't want to do that shit. It's like, no, I just don't want to do it. It's not, I mean, I don't know if I could do it, but I didn't want to. But if you want to do the thing, which is what you're doing, I reckon you do put that champion mentality into what you do, but you just...
It's pretty moving. It's pretty moving to watch it. Like, I find it...
Oh, yeah. Oh, mate, sports documentaries do not... I mean, we're crying just always. They're just the best.
Yeah. Normally laid up on my couch eating a bag of crisps.
Yeah, of course.
Going, that guy is a revelation.
Do you know what's in a really interesting doc, actually, that I just watched? The Kanye doc. Obviously, the first two episodes... of the three, especially because he just believes so much in himself that he, and it's crazy because it's also really good to watch as a person in this, it was a different industry, but like he's playing the graduation. He's already renowned as a good producer by is it Rockefeller, and he's playing them this album. He goes into the offices and they're just trying to, they're annoyed by him. They're like, no, you're not, you're a producer, you're not a rapper. But he's so determined and he gets so many setbacks along the way, but he just keeps going and doesn't give up and keeps doing it until he becomes, and then it's kind of, as soon as he gets famous, like the switch goes and it's kind of a little bit tragic in a way on the final episode. But I guess he had that like, is it not just even a famous guy energy? He had that like, I was born to have my music listened to by millions, and all. it's very inspiring actually. So I recommend.
I'm really curious about that, because I wonder if the flip side to that is being a little bit mad.
Yeah, I mean, like, there is
when sane people go. Yeah, I mean, but he was right to keep going because he is a genius. But there has to be that kind of no, you don't understand. I am a genius, which I don't quite know what I'm saying.
No, I know. He seems
mentally unwell. He seems quite unwell.
He is bipolar, isn't he? I think is kind of what the diagnosis is. And there's that fine line between genius and madness. And yeah, maybe it's, you kind of go.
But then is there also something about the, I have certainly, I mean, from a distance, noticed that there is something about the American system that surrounds people with enablers to the point where, really unhinged behavior is allowed and indulged. And then there is an incident where people go, whoa, wait a second.
Yeah.
But it's like there is an organism around this human that has enabled this for a decade.
They need more British people. They need more British people going, bit much, mate, bit much.
I mean, I remember watching Sean Locke doing Just for Laughs, like a Montreal thing.
Yeah.
And I think there was some big fireworks explosion and he sort of walked out on stage and it was all very, you know, it's all very North American. And he sort of looked around and just went, that was a bit much, wasn't it? started his set.
Very funny. All right, let's, before we wrap this up then, I'm just curious to know, your dad at the start of your career was a bit, you know,
He was brutal.
But now you're, you know, in maybe you're not in your head successful, but I, you know, I'm going to say as an outsider, successful, and you're making it your career and doing all the fun things. Does he watch your stuff? Does your mum watch your stuff? Are they supportive?
Yeah,
do they not have a clue? That's good. Good, good.
They're incredibly proud. And they've really seen, they've seen how hard I've worked for it. Like, great. They have been with me at festivals. They had seen me, you know, when I first started doing festivals, and then when I had my kids, and they would come to festivals to help me. And they saw me, you know, Edinburgh can break the strongest spirit.
Of course.
And they saw how hard I worked for it. They were like, they couldn't have been happier for me, because they really, you know, when I sort of hit the reset button and I had two young kids and, you know, they would come to Melbourne and come to Edinburgh to help me with the kids so that I could do the shows and do the stage time and have a little afternoon nap. I remember there was one Edinburgh that I did, and it was my first festival back, having been off having babies, and I sort of was like, I've got to get back on the horse, and I just wasn't selling very well, and it was a good show, but it wasn't, the reviews were great, but I had a bad time. So it was like a storytelling show, mm-hmm. but it was on at 9:30 in the Pleasance beside, and it's a really big room for a later show. Like, it should have been 5 PM,
yeah.
but it wasn't. And the show just wasn't selling very well, you know, and I'd got to halfway through the festival and I wasn't really filling it beyond 60% most nights, mm-hmm. which by halfway through you're like, I can't turn it around now. You know, like, I've got 12 days left and I can't turn the ship around now. And I went out for, my dad said I wanted, because I was getting depressed. I was getting really depressed because I'd worked so hard on this show and it hadn't quite landed commercially. And I went out for lunch with my dad and I just started sobbing. I just couldn't stop crying. And he said, why are you crying? I'm going to get tearful.
It's okay.
He said,
this is a safe space.
He said, where? And he said, why are you crying? And I said, I'm just so sorry. I'm so sorry that this show's a failure. Like, I've given it everything. I couldn't have worked harder on this show. Like, I've done the homework and I ran it in 40 times. I did 40 previews and I rewrote it and I rewrote it and no one's showing up and I'm so sorry. And he was so lovely. He started crying and he said, "You have to apologize. Like, are you crazy? You know, like, yeah. I love you and I'm so proud of you." And so that they've seen all that, you know, they've seen, it's not like I went and decided to do stand up and then was given a TV show. Like, they've seen the 20 years of, you know, so yeah. There you go, Chris. I fucking cried on your dumb podcast. Are you happy now?
That's what I say to Paul. Give me an hour and I'll make anyone cry. No, thank you for sharing. I think that's a lovely story that could be, it's understandably, it could be really sad, but it's also really lovely that your dad.
And that's why they're just so happy for me with the show, and
that's great.
You know, but even then I had to say to them, I might not get a series three, guys.
Come on, we all know that series three stuff goes down the shitter anyway.
It does.
So there's a reason why British shows are normally two seasons. American, you're like on season, there's shows that I do really like that do a lot of seasons, but then sometimes you're like, all right, there's certain things that happen. I think by season six on something, I was like, I mean, this is just quite frankly ridiculous. Like in Dexter, when, spoiler alert, I mean, they've re-brought it back, but I don't know if you ever watched Dexter, but when his sister found out in like season six, I was like, all right, I'm done. This is the whole premise is gone now. But it's hard. It's hard to write 2 million episodes of a TV show. But let's do a tiny gear change before we wrap it up.
Sure.
My dad, I get him to research my guests. Some of them, he doesn't. I'll be honest, he knew Zoe Lyons because I think he saw her once in Edinburgh because I supported her on tour a few years ago. Anyway, but he doesn't know anyone. He doesn't know anyone on the planet, let alone generally guests. So, but I did get him to research you. Uh-huh. I thought he's normally quite good at this, but he dropped the ball a bit. But anyway, he's got a question for you. So I think producer Paul will play you the question and feel free to answer how you like.
How did you get into comedy and did it live up to your expectations?
Oh, there we go. That's a big question. That's a question of a man that has not researched the guest properly to have a specific question.
Where do you get your ideas? I got into comedy at university. I was very frightened of it. I was very frightened of stand-up and I was very frightened of any public performance. I'd done a little bit of other stuff at uni, like a bit of sketch stuff and a bit of improv, and had sort of enjoyed it but not really enjoyed it. But I kind of knew I was sort of swimming in the right pool, but I just wasn't in the correct lane, if we were going to extend that metaphor.
That was good. I liked it.
Okay, thank you. Then I did stand up and I had an almost allergic reaction to public performance. I vomited and I had explosive diarrhea. It wasn't a food bug, it was nerves. It was incredible. I was so nervous. But the gig went okay. I didn't kill it, but it went okay. Mm-hmm. And it went okay enough for me to go, this is interesting to me. I think what really attracted me to it was in every other thing that I'd done, I was relying on other people when I was on the stage. And there was something I really liked about stand-up, that if you wrote it quite meticulously and learnt it, you know, because I had to factor in that nerves were going to blind me in the moment. So I knew I was going to have to know it off by heart. But there was something about it that I could completely control that space. I was like, there's a microphone and a spotlight and everybody has to listen. Obviously they can stop listening if they don't like it, but there was an autonomy and a power to that, that, I felt so thrilled at the control that I had. And I remember when I started gigging a bit, and I really liked comics. I found that I really liked comedians. Like, in a way, I sort of found myself socially, and that I was like, oh, these are my people. These are like, I really fit in well with these people. Like, I loved backstage. I loved, you know, the whole feeling backstage. That I really liked the social aspect of it. But I felt this sort of, it's like my life had become extraordinary. Like, I was at uni, and then I dropped uni and I was working in a bar, but I would get up on stage and do stand-up, and it made my life, I felt like a superhero or something. Like, I was doing this thing that was, when you tell people that, you know, like when you go, I'm a stand-up, and they go, oh my God, I could never do that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I just kind of felt like I'd found this thing that made my life feel really vivid. It felt more interesting. It felt like I was like a tightrope walker or something. It really thrilled me. And gave me a lot of pride. It gave me so much pride. I was really proud of myself. I was like, yeah, I'm fucking doing something that people are generally quite frightened of.
Mm-hmm. You're making me want to just go and do a gig right now, even though it's 9 a.m. where I am. Any given Sunday, like, speech. I'm into it, mate.
Yeah, I'll fly you over to do Old Rope and let's see how you feel.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I do. I love that gig. That gig's
it's my favourite. Old Rope is my favourite gig. It is to this day my favourite.
Mate, that's awesome. That's a lovely answer. What an inspiring answer. The final thing we get our guests to do, I don't know what I said myself in the royal we, Paul's producer.
I know what you mean.
Have you got any words of encouragement to help my dad say I love you to me? Just to get him to crack that nut. Obviously, when he says it, the whole premise of the podcast is ruined because he hasn't said it yet. But anything you want to just sort of give him a little hint.
I know that he does. He does. So there's no, if anything, it's the smallest part of loving someone is saying it, because the act of loving the person is the really big thing. So really he just needs to get his head around the fact that it's the word bit is the nothing bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's the fact that he actually loves you that is the wonderful. He doesn't have to say it, but it's a nice thing for us to let the people in our life know how loved they are. Otherwise, it's a very lonely journey.
It is. It is. That's true. That's it. Don't leave me alone on the journey, Dad.
Yeah, Dad.
Say it. Sarah, this has been, what a treat this has been.
Oh, it's been lovely. I've really enjoyed
it. It's been years, but it's been just a good...
It's not all about volume. It's about the quality.
Yeah, that's a different version of quality, not quantity. It's the volume.
Yeah.
That's your own version, your own spin on that. Can't plug your show. It's great. I would tell people about
my show, Afraid. It's on HBO Max and Sky and Now TV in the UK and ABC TV in Australia. Look, fuck, do what you want. Watch it.
Go watch Afraid. It's great. And there's two series or two seasons, depending on which country you live in, how you say it. Go watch it. It's brilliant. Anything else people can watch you, see you on, do anything with you at?
Nah, not at the moment.
Go fight you. Where's your dojo?
Is in St. Margaret's. My dojo is in St. Margaret's, it's great. I love it. I really love it. And I'm going to be doing a tournament in September. I'm doing my first tournament.
I'd love that if you got like 20 podcast fans watching you. You'd have like supporters in a tournament. Yeah. That'd be so good.
I expect I'm going to get my ass kicked and go home feeling very embarrassed. I think that's the generally accepted. The first thing that happens at your first tournament is you just get stunned by the violence and go home and go, oh, okay, next time I have to be ready for much more violence.
I know I'm going to get you, if I see you near a birthday or at Christmas, I'm going to get you some Cobra Kai stash, mate. That's what I'm getting you as a present.
Do it, mate.
A bag.
Do it.
Sarah, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Bye.
I love you. There you go.
A podcast from producer paul.co.uk.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.